Do you have any recipe suggestions for the listener?
Well, I like it. I like salmon plank smoked on a cedar plank.
Okay.
Yeah, that is good. Good, good. Maple syrup on top.
Be careful. Be careful to soak the plank for a good 2 hours that it smokes and doesn't burn up on your barbecue grill. But...
The New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, featuring your hosts, Gabe Reinick and Ken Holyoke.
Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. I'm Gabe Reinick from the banks of the Merrimack River, and I'm joined, as I am just about every fortnight, by Ken Holyoke, who appears to be in Lethbridge, Alberta. How are you, Ken?
Not too bad. No, I'm not a couple blocks away from the Neville site, but I am just a 45-minute drive from Wally's Beach.
Well, there you go. Yeah, that's good. How far are you from Head Smash, Dan?
About probably 30 minutes, 30, 35 minutes. Yeah, yeah. I'm kind of smack dab between Head Smashton and Ace and Apier. Writing on Stone is just to the east as well. So.
Oh, yeah, tough life.
Yeah, lots of World Heritage in close proximity.
Yes. But speaking of time travel, Ken, we've had a heck of an afternoon here in studio, because I believe this is the first time that we have recorded an episode, and then we've traveled backwards in time after recording that episode to record the hit piece for the thing we're introing today.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then jumping ahead now to this.
Yes.
Also time travel, I think.
I think that counts as time travel, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And Ken, I think one of the things that's at least done for me is it means that I want to remind myself right now that we are about to interview Gary Copeland.
We are. Yeah. 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 So as I gave you guys a heads up on the previous episode, adjust your subwoofers.
Yes. Yes. Or maybe just woofers. And so, Ken, one of the things that the listener might notice about our interview with Gary Copeland is not only are we time traveling, we're switching coasts.
We are. Yeah, we are. We're headed to the left coast.
The left coast. Okay. Yeah. And so that's sort of interesting, because we're called the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, and it's not Fort New Brunswick, which is what it would be called if it was somewhere in the northwest coast, I assume.
Yeah, could be. Yeah. Yeah. We're bi-coastal now.
Yes. And so, Ken, you actually, you worked in the northwest coast for a little while, right? Or in the northwest, anyway.
Yeah, it was the sort of interior plateau. So the northern extent, actually, of the plateau region. So
interesting.
The Fraser Plateau.
Okay, so no one would be more equipped to evaluate new names for our podcast than you.
Well, I've got a geographic coverage in Canada of the of Canadian archaeology, I guess, from BC to Labrador, so from the far west to the far east. Yeah,
that's exactly what people usually mean when they say the far east. The east of Woodstock, west of Vietnam, listener.
Exactly.
Ken. Emmanuel has let us know that he thinks that we've got some growth potential on this podcast, and one of the ways to do that might be to better convey what it is we do on this podcast, and that it's not just about New Brunswick, really.
That is right. We are spreading our wings and going elsewhere, and we, you know, we're always on a mission to think about what a new name for this podcast would be, and I don't think, Gabe, we talk about this all the time, but we would never take an idea and not give compensation for those ideas.
No, that would be plagiarism.
That would be plagiarism, right? Yeah. And so this week we've got a special package lined up for the listener. Uh-huh. And it's coming at you like the feeling of revulsion that you get when Hotel California starts playing. That's right. If you've had a rough night and you hate the Eagles, have we got something for you, listener, if you can rename the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. And so we'll be starting with an all-expenses-paid trip to the West Coast to visit the Haida Gwaii Museum, where you're going to see a reconstruction of a Haida plank house on a guided tour by one of the resident experts in Skidigat. We'll then hop the float plane back to the mainland, where we're going to check out the Pacific Angler Fishing Charters and take in a full 10-hour Vancouver Salmon Charter with the overnight option to the Gulf Islands. This will then be paired with lunch on your second day with that salmon done right. Yes, it will be on the cedar plank. It will be soaked properly. And because it's one of my favorite accoutrements, it will be glazed with a rosemary bourbon maple syrup using BC's own BRBN bourbon-style Canadian whiskey from the Okanagan Distillery.
That's lovely.
But careful, man, there's a beverage here and a pairing that will knock your socks off and set your afternoon into a blur. That's right, the continuous hopping. This is a process that involves adding hops over the course of 90-minute boil, bringing out the prominent hints of grapefruit, pine, and citrus, is found in every pitcher of my favorite lunch beer, Bone Shaker, from Amsterdam Breweries.
What percent?
While the aggression against your liver may stand, you certainly will not after this nosh up. And despite the wobbles in your day, your day is not over. No, we're about to indulge in some White Russians and joining your friends, colleagues, and special invitees to the Real Room in downtown Vancouver, where you'll be treated to a private screening of the 1998 Coen Brothers classic, The Big Lebowski. Now, we wouldn't be the NB Arc Pod if we weren't about shameless self-promotion. So on top of this two-day West Coast delight, you're going to go home after this extravaganza with an NB Arc Pod custom-embroidered rug to pull any room together and your very own Yulekin candle for those short days and long nights ahead. That's right, the dude abides, but so does the NB Arc Pod. And listener, this package is all for you if you can rename the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast.
Wow, listener, you're not going to want to miss that Courvoisier White Russian. And so, Ken, where would the lucky listener send in the winning entry to this competition?
They would send that winning entry to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That is New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word, archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. And you can also find us on Instagram @new_brunswick_archaeology, and archaeology spelled the same way.
That's right. And Ken, if you look into that mailbag today, what have we got in there tomorrow, yesterday, today? I don't even know where we are, but have a look.
So we don't have any fresh listener mail. We have a new YouTube subscriber. So Akadakad1 has subscribed. Mm-hmm, so welcome to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. And I thought that it was appropriate because the only email in here is actually a CC that we have. Mm-hmm. We are welcoming a new member of the team, of the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast here in the next couple of weeks. And so although you won't probably here, you might start to see some of the work that Cody is going to be doing with us here on the podcast. And so we're a team of four in it.
And so stay tuned because Cody's going to be doing some work on our website, on our social media. Basically, Cody's going to be focused on user experience.
Exactly. And so Cody and Emmanuel are going to be working together. Emmanuel has given us great instruction on growth potential, which we have frequently not done a whole lot with, but you never know, listener, we might tie into those algorithms and see that SEO fly off the shelves.
Yes, that's right. All right, listener, well, thank you for tuning in. And one thing Ken and I would like to encourage you to do is, in addition to we always love getting your mail, we also love seeing the number of stars that this podcast has increase on all platforms. So if this evening when you're sipping a White Russian and enjoying the remainder of summer or winter, frankly, wherever you are, because I have no idea when you're going to be listening to this, go ahead and slide over and press those likes to help our SEO or whatever it's called when it's a podcast increase.
Yeah, yeah. Like, subscribe, give us a 5-star. And even better, if you want to give us 5 stars and you want to write a review, my understanding is that all that engagement grows the podcast.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right, Ken, I guess that's probably enough from us, and we'll hand it over to Gary Copeland.
Yes, I think that's the right idea. Talk to you soon, listener.
Talk to you soon, listener.
We are joined today by Dr. Gary Copeland, who is a professor emeritus of anthropology at University of Toronto, where he taught and supervised multiple generations of archaeologists, starting in 1988 until his retirement in 2022. Gary's academic legacy spans the country, and former graduate students, myself among them, are now in faculty positions themselves, some with their own academic legacies. His dudeliness has a BA in archaeology from University of Toronto, an MA in anthropology from Trent University, where he studied Andean hill forts, and his PhD in anthropology from UBC. Gary is the former president of the Canadian Archaeological Association, the former editor of the Canadian Journal of Archaeology. He's published 4 books, including the book on the prehistory of the Northwest Coast with R.G. Mattson. He's published dozens of peer-reviewed publications and has decades of research on two major projects, the Sechelt Archaeology Project, based out of Sechelt Traditional Territory northwest of Vancouver, and the Northwest Coast Housing Project, based out of Prince Rupert Harbour. This work makes Gary a specialist in Northwest Coast archaeology, specifically the development of inequality, hierarchy, and trans-egalitarian societies in that region, and a guru of household archaeology. He's joining us today from the East End in Toronto to talk about these topics, and welcome to the podcast, Gary.
Thanks for joining us, Gary. I'm excited to talk about Andy and Hillforts for the next half hour. But we're a podcast that's primarily aimed at an East Coast audience. I mean, although we're of course continental in scale. But before we get going, could you give us just an overview of what people mean when they talk about the Northwest Coast, what it represents as a cultural geography, and why it's such an important and well-known region in the archaeology of North America?
Okay, the Northwest Coast basically refers to the long strip, north to south strip of Pacific coastline of North America. From north to south, it includes, generally taken to include the Alaska Panhandle, or southeastern Alaska, what's commonly called the Panhandle, the entire coast of British Columbia, the entire coast of Washington State, Oregon State, and maybe even the very, very far northern coast of California. So from geographically, that's the location. It mainly refers to the coastal areas of that long strip, although the Northwest Coast also includes a number of rivers that come out of the mountains. It's a very, very rugged region topographically, with coastal mountains, especially in BC and southeastern Alaska. A number of rivers cut through those mountains. Northwest Coast culture is taken to include groups that lived along the lower courses of those rivers, either permanently or seasonally. What else can I say? The northern coastline in particular, again, southeast Alaska, BC, is very, very rugged because it's so mountainous. So it's a true fjord coastline, lots of long, deep inlets, which kind of maximizes the extent of the coastline because it's not one long straight coastline. Farther south, the outer Washington coast, the Oregon coast, tend to be more straighter coastlines. And that may have had some cultural implications in the past as well. But I think the last key point that I want to make is that, and you asked about the cultural relevance of the Northwest Coast. Well, of course, it's the region of the potlatch, which I think every introductory anthropology student in university learns about. It's also the region of what some have come to call complex hunter-gatherers. I know we're going to get into more of a discussion of that as we go along. And it's a region of fast-flowing rivers that empty into these inlets and along the coastline, the Fraser River, the Columbia River, farther north where I worked, the Skeena River. And many smaller rivers in between, almost all of which get major salmon runs. Major annual runs of Pacific salmon, which became the main, not only, but the main food source for people living along that coast in the region for the past 10,000 years, and probably was a main resource driver of this complexity that we're going to go on and take a look at a little bit later. So,
yeah, that's right. And so you mentioned, the intro to anthropology, potlatch, and tying in with complex hunter-gatherers. And so, that term's used to describe some of the Northwest Coast groups. And can you give us sort of a rundown of what we are talking about when we're saying complex hunter-gatherers and when and where that category is applied, basically what it looks like archaeologically?
Sure. Well, I think it's probably useful to take that term complex hunter-gatherers and divide it into two parts, the complex part and the hunter-gatherer part. By hunter-gatherers, we mean people who hunted, who fished, and who foraged for their food with little or no reliance on domesticates. So they didn't grow corn, they didn't grow rice, they didn't have domesticated animal herds. Complex is a more loaded term that I think we'll get into more of a discussion here. Complex in the sense of complex societies. Now, I think when anthropologists probably a century ago or more coined that term, wherever it came from, complex societies, you know, what were they referring to? I think they were referring to societies from the middle, say, of the last 5,000 years, mainly in the Middle East, the Near East, perhaps to a certain extent in the Far East, and a little bit later on in Mesoamerica and maybe Andean South America and maybe a few other regions of the world too. Societies that had urbanism, people lived in cities. Societies that had a state level of political organization. And the catch term, I think, for that, urbanism and the state, was societies with civilization, right? But civilization is a loaded term. What do you mean by civilization? Who's not civilized, right? Who gets to be civilized and who's not civilized?
Ken, that's a rhetorical question. Don't answer that, Ken.
Well,
we're about to get real political here.
We're getting real political. So we'll just leave that hanging for a second. And move to the term hunter-gatherer. I mean, complexity is defined by a few other traits as well. High population density, as you would expect with urbanism and maybe with the state. Specialized production, where we got it here. Sedentism, as you would expect with urbanism. Large-scale storage. So complex societies, complexity becomes in that sense a kind of a trait list of things. And you are complex or not complex to the degree that your culture includes any number of these traits.
Yeah, and there's sort of that, Ken Sassaman has a paper where there's sort of this ticky box. The traditional approach has been this kind of checklist.
The old guard trait list. Yeah, the trait list approach, which is, you know, is problematic in a number of ways. And I think one more trait that ties complexity and hunter-gatherers together, maybe in a sort of negative way, is that it was always assumed that complexity, one of the key traits of complexity, was agriculture, large-scale food production. And you couldn't be civilized, you couldn't have civilization without agriculture. So that left hunter-gatherers out. Now, I think what we see on the Northwest Coast is that some of those tick boxes of traits that you're talking about, Ken, do seem to apply, maybe even limited cultivation. There are a few examples. But without fully developed agriculture anywhere on the Northwest Coast traditionally. So can you be complex in the absence of agriculture? Can you be a complex hunter-gatherer? I have colleagues, when I started at University of Toronto, one of the famous anthropologists there was Richard Lee, who simply took the term complex hunter-gatherers to be an oxymoron. Can't be. Cannot be. But nevertheless, on the West Coast, you had people who potlatched, produced great amounts of wealth, who revered status differences among families and among individuals, had a lot of inequality, hereditary inequality, but by and large did not farm, except with a few exceptions that we can go on to talk about. So maybe it's not an oxymoron after all. And there are, of course, around the world, some other examples that we could point to as well.
And so a lot of your work, Gary, is focused really on the inequality aspect of complexity among hunter-gatherers.
Right. And I mean, early in my career, I guess I was happy enough to use the term complexity and talk about complex hunter-gatherers. Some literature came along, maybe beginning about 20 years ago, or maybe even a little more. Randall McGuire, Madonna Moss on the West Coast, a few others who were questioning and critiquing the use of the term complexity and saying, this is a term we really, it's vague. It's a term we link with a kind of a progressive evolutionary model that is kind of 19th century in origin. And along that vein, I began thinking about that, and I began, taking note of that critique. And along that vein, I would add, it's also a complexity is largely a colonial concept that has probably very little meaning in the sense that we use it, cultural complexity, complex societies, probably has very little meaning or relevance to indigenous Northwest Coast groups, and certainly not to their ancestors hundreds and thousands of years ago. So it's a term that very much needs to be unpacked. And as I thought more and more about that, I began to think, you know, what I'm really interested in is not urbanism and agriculture and so on. What I'm really interested in is the inequality, the forms of inequality that are usually associated with complexity. And how these forms of inequality are represented on the Northwest Coast. And so I began to kind of parse it and narrow down my interest from complexity in the large, vague, amorphous sense to something that you could, I think, define more clearly and just get your hands on and work with more clearly.
And so, yeah. When you talk about inequality, what do you mean by inequality?
The term I used in one of the papers we had that I guess we're going to talk a little bit about, in which very large numbers of beads were recovered in burial context, mortuary context. The term we were using is material wealth-based inequality. You know, for it to be archaeologically useful and usable, I think that materiality has to be involved there somewhere, or, you know, how do we approach it as archaeologists? So the materiality in this example were the hundreds of thousands of beads, stone beads that we recovered. Material wealth-based inequality. We argued that those beads, which were mortuary offerings, but also recovered in some other contexts as well, not just in burials, were a form of wealth, that those beads represented wealth. And a kind of fungible wealth in the sense that you take one bead, you take another bead, you take hundreds of thousands of beads, they all look pretty much alike, right? And they can be assumed, or I assumed, each bead pretty much has the same value. being careful to note that the history of each of these beads, who owned these beads or those beads previous to their internment, could also add to or subtract from their value. So their history is not irrelevant, is important, but it's, you know, it really looked to me like you've seen one bead, you've seen them all. They're like pennies.
Yeah, that's how I feel about rocks, actually, Ken.
Yeah, they're like stone pennies, and each with roughly the same value. So could that be treated as wealth? And I thought that it could. And so, you know, one, you can examine inequality from the standpoint of material wealth differences. Why is it that some of these contexts, whether the beads are recovered from a burial or from a house floor or whatever their context, why do we find tens of thousands and even hundreds of thousands in some contexts, but only a handful in other contexts? Is that a representation, a material representation of inequality? Depends obviously on the contexts, but can we investigate inequality from that standpoint? And I thought we could, and so.
Yeah, and for the listener, the big difference here is that traditionally in hunting and gathering societies, we tend to view hunter-gatherers as egalitarian, right? That everybody kind of has the same access to food and to other the needs of life and subsistence.
Right.
Whereas in these complex hunter-gatherer situations or these unequal situations on the Northwest Coast, what you're seeing is changes within particular houses, like actual structures. Some are bigger, some are smaller, but then even within those houses, some people seem to have more things than other people.
Exactly. And, you know, one, I think a good way to put it is, you raised the point, Ken, is, you know, my old colleague Richard Lee, who I love dearly and highly respect, would say that among egalitarian hunter-gatherers, and Richard would kind of, and aren't they all, what matters most is sharing. You know, what I have is yours if you need it. What you have is mine if I need it. You know, we live, we survive, we do well or we don't do well on the basis of sharing and how well we share what we've got. On the Northwest Coast, A.L. Kroeber, famous anthropologist from a century ago, wrote, "What seems to matter most to these people is possession." And he went through a long list of things that could be possessed, not just material wealth, but oral history, family crests, all kinds, songs, stories that can be only told by a certain person. What mattered most was possession. Well, that's a long way from what matters most is sharing. In fact, I think some would say that's almost oppositional. And so what interested me was how did this emphasis on possession come about? And it's, you know, where, you know, did many societies in their past go through this kind of moment where an emphasis on sharing suddenly began to change to an emphasis on possession? What are the conditions under which that happens? Or in all societies going way back into prehistory, can we say, well, there were moments when sharing was emphasized, and then there were moments when possession might be emphasized? And it's not a replacement of one by the other, but it could be a kind of back and forth, almost cyclical relationship between the two as living conditions and other sorts of things, social conditions change.
And so on the Northwest Coast, about how long ago and what were kind of the factors that drove, like when did this sort of appearance of inequality begin and And, you know, was there something kind of, was there a driving event? Was there a particular, you know, was it all salmon all the time or a variety of different things? We don't, you know, it's not easy to point to one.
Well,
sometimes it's smoked, sometimes it's wind dried. As long as it's salmon, that's the key, I think.
It was not all salmon all the time, but, and I would have a number of Northwest Coast archaeological colleagues who would really get on my case if I said it was all about salmon and nothing else. There were
the listener doesn't realize I've got some of Gary's old slides, and one of the terms that's on there is to be wary of salmonopia.
Right.
Is the when thinking about the Northwest Coast,
which credit where credit's due was actually a term that I think Greg Monks, now retired from University of Manitoba, very good West Coast archaeologist, he coined the term salmonopia. Failure, inability to see the other resources for the salmon. There's an old saying on the West Coast, when the tide rolls out, the table is set. And they're talking about there about shellfish and all the intertidal resources that are suddenly available for a 5 or 6 hour period until the tide rolls back in again. And sea mammals and all kinds of other fish, not just salmon you know, what was critical there, and I think what underpinned inequality, complexity, whatever you want to call it, on the Northwest Coast, in lieu of agriculture, in the absence of highly developed agriculture, was a natural resource base, a wild resource base that was incredibly bountiful. With a number of seasonal resources that could be caught taken in very large numbers, salmon, again, being a very good example, but not the only one, taken in very large amounts when available, when they run in the rivers, and that's usually from midsummer on into the autumn. And then they can be readily preserved for storage, either through smoking or wind drying, which Gabe mentioned, and preserved for storage and made to last through the lean season in the winter and carry people right on into the spring and early summer of the following year. The general consensus is availability of food was never a problem. There was more than enough that you could eat at any given time. And so you could take as much as you wanted or needed, some to be preserved for future use, for future consumption, but also some that could be transformed through trade and exchange into other forms of wealth. You know, those stored food resources themselves could have been seen as a form of wealth. And certainly trading dried fish for beads or other kinds of material wealth was a possibility, was certainly definitely done. A wild food base that could underpin complexity in much the same way that agriculture underpinned complexity in other parts of the world. And if you look at regions around the world where we have other examples of complex hunter-gatherers, like coastal Southern California, coastal Scandinavia, the Mesolithic of coastal, the far north in Europe, the Near Eastern Natufian, you're looking again at areas where certain wild food resources were bountiful enough that they could support not just subsistence, but the surplus production, the production of surplus above and beyond subsistence, that surplus could be transformed into wealth, and that wealth becomes the basis for inequality. I mean, it's not surprising that where you have fjord coastlines in the world, if you go back far enough in time, you probably have pretty good examples of complex hunter-gatherers. And the Northwest Coast is just one of those regions.
That's interesting.
And so, Gary, you've had two major long-term projects that have dug into these topics, and they've been located in different parts of the BC coast, and at Seychelles and at Prince Rupert. And so how do those places differ? And in terms of the archaeology, how related or not are the groups that are in each of those places?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I started after I finished my PhD, which was also in northern BC, but not coastal. It was on the Skeena River at a location called Kitsilas Canyon. And then after I finished that, I began a project. You mentioned the Northwest Coast Housing Project at Prince Rupert. And the main reason I shifted to Prince Rupert, which was maybe just 150 kilometers down the Skeena River to the coast at Prince Rupert, the main reason that I made that shift was because in coastal contexts like Prince Rupert, the sites are usually defined as shell midden sites, where there are large deposits of shell. That shell, I know this is going to be one of your next questions, so I'm jumping the gun here, but that that shell, mussel shell, clam shells, etc., that are deposited in these large mounds and middens, you know, which are literally garbage dumps, enhanced preservation in soil conditions that would otherwise be very acidic and would have very poor preservation. So you get very good organic preservation in shell. And I thought the one thing that I was missing at Kitsilas that I would be able to get at farther down at the coast, and Prince Rupert was the nearest coastal location, the one thing I would be able to get would be lots and lots of fish bones and deer bones and bones from all other animals out of the...
But mostly salmon.
Well, that's what I wanted to see. Is that yeah. That's what we assumed was the case at Kitsilas, because it was on the Skeena River. It was a canyon. It was the first, as you go upriver from the coast, which is what salmon do when they migrate, it was the first constriction on the river where there was, you know, canyon conditions with rapids, a critical, critical salmon fishing location. Village sites, archaeological sites with evidence of permanent houses were right there. So we knew that people were living in villages there, and I assumed they're living in villages here because the salmon fishing is so good. But I can't test that idea, because we don't get very good bone preservation because there are no shell middens when you're 150 kilometers up the river. So we started a project at Prince Rupert, and where there was good bone preservation in the shell middens. And not surprisingly, we found tons and tons of salmon bone. And by far and away, salmon was the most common faunal animal resource in these middens compared to everything else combined. And so they were really salmon specialists, along with some shell food to balance out the diet, and a little bit of deer bone, but very little bit, and very, very little of other fish.
Do you have any recipe suggestions for the listener?
Well, I like it. I like salmon plank smoked on a cedar plank.
Okay.
Yeah, that is good. Good. Maple syrup on top.
Be careful to soak the plank for a good 2 hours that it smokes and doesn't burn up on your barbecue grill. And so what we also found at Prince Rupert was were sites, many sites, that had evidence of permanent villages. These were clearly village sites, a couple of thousand, 3,000 years old, some more, even older. And we knew they were villages because of the deep shell middens at the back of the site farthest from the shoreline. And in between the shoreline and the big deep shell middens, were evidence on the surface of the ground of what were clearly house floors.
Roughly, it's like big depressions, basically.
Depression.
Big depressions, yeah.
What we would call house depressions. And these were long and narrow, rectangular in shape, sites with 8, 9, 10 house depressions, other sites with 25, 30 house depression features. Often arranged side houses arranged side by side in rows, often with two rows or even three rows of houses as you proceed from the shoreline up the bank and farther back towards the big deep shell midden. And these house features, right, they gave us tremendous opportunity to record a lot of different things without even much excavation, which was always very good. We could record the size of the house depressions and get a very good idea of the size of the houses that once stood on these spots. And we began to recognize that in some of these villages, the houses were about 50, 60 square meters in size. Maybe an extended family or maybe two related families living in them, 8, 10 people, maybe a dozen, but probably not more than that. And then there were a couple of houses, house depressions in the site that were quite a bit larger than all of the others. So the question became, A, were these bigger houses clearly residential houses that people lived in, or did they have another purpose, ceremonial, ritual, perhaps? And B, if they are residential, who lived in these houses? Why are they so much bigger? Could these have been houses owned and occupied by high-status chiefs? And so that required some excavation and a fairly large scale excavation. And we would try to limit the, it's very time consuming. We try to limit the excavation to do as little destruction of the site as possible, but we're still after certain kinds of data. Are there more wealth items coming from these larger houses? What about the food remains in these larger houses? Are they the same? Is there more salmon? Is there less salmon than in the smaller houses? With that kind of strategy and with those kinds of sites, you could start to do some comparisons and look for evidence of inequality. A point that just went through my mind about 10 minutes ago, but I come back to it now. I don't like excavating burials. And at Shishal, we were asked by the Shishal Nation to excavate some burials at a site called Quentin McQuali. You asked me to compare Prince Rupert to the farther south, so I'm getting to that now. We never excavated any burials in Prince Rupert in 15 years of field research there. We certainly came across human burials and human remains. As soon as we did, we stopped excavating, stopped digging. Reported it to the relevant First Nations and stopped excavation. What do you want us to do with this? We would like you to not excavate any of the burials of our ancestors. At Shishal, we had a different context, which will remind me to get back to this in a minute. But by and large, I have never wanted to excavate burials. You're digging up somebody's ancestors. How would you like it if they did that to your ancestors, all of that? So, but it's well known amongst archaeologists, if you want to look for inequality, and in particular, material wealth-based inequality, you're most likely to find it in the grave offerings, in burials. And you're most likely going to be able to see the difference between a powerful chief, high-status chief, based on that person's grave offerings, and someone else who was of much lower status based on their grave offerings. You're going to find a lot more wealth in the chief's grave. So is there a way that we can investigate inequality without disturbing burials? And I thought a good way to do that would be to look at house features. And instead of comparing wealth and other goods from burials, we'd be comparing whatever we recovered from a number of different excavated house features. Big houses, small houses, houses in between. And see if some of these ideas about the size of a house, the number of people who lived in a house, who provided labor and fishing and so on for that household, correlated with, you know, different forms of wealth, different amounts of wealth, number of beads.
Amount of salmon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amount of salmon for sure. Different type. who had more sockeye? Who had more, you know, coho salmon? Yeah. And who had other types that may not have been as greatly valued? You know, all kinds of things.
Just to interrupt for a second here on the salmon thing. So, like, Brian Hayden has that kind of famous example of different types of salmon in different houses. Right. Up in the plateau. And do you see the same kind of patterning in some of these bigger houses, that there's different varieties or older, larger salmon in the bigger houses?
Yeah.
Is that?
We did. I think what we found is that in the larger houses, and Hayden and his project at Keatley Creek, and Ann Apprentice, who worked at Keatley Creek and some other locations nearby in the Middle Fraser, they did got a lot more extensively into identification of different salmon species, from the vertebrate remains that were recovered, the bone remains that were of salmon that were recovered, from DNA studies and so on. They got a lot more into that than we were ever able to do. But it seemed pretty clear in some of the house features that we excavated in Prince Rupert, that there was evidence of three or four different species of salmon remains recovered from that house, which happened to be one of the bigger houses. And from the smaller houses, not 100% certain of this, but it did look like there was less variety of salmon, more exclusively focused on the remains of maybe pink salmon or chum or something like that. So, you know, what do you make of that if, you know, people in one house have a greater variety? There are five or six different species of Pacific salmon. If you find the remains of four or five of those species in one house, but only one or two species in the other, what do you make of that? I would say there's an economic difference there, and it's probably a social difference as well. So, you know, what I was getting to there is that I think excavating house features, doing household archaeology, provides, in this sense, a good alternative, and certainly a preferable alternative, to doing mortuary archaeology. We can get at some of those same questions about inequality and economic and social differences through household archaeology. And also we get at something, I think, that's very, very different from the mortuary concept. You know, burials are ritual and ceremonial, and they don't happen all the time. So the archaeology of mortuary context is an archaeology of ritual and ceremony. The archaeology of houses that people lived in is an archaeology of everyday life, the quotidian. I think that allows you to ask a whole series of different questions about understanding society and economics in the past that you would never get you'd never be able to ask those questions out of mortuary context if you did excavate them. And I should point out that at Shishaw, we had a site, Quentin McQuali, which I thought was a village site, and I thought we might be able to do the kind of household archaeology that we had done in Prince Rupert, in my previous project, that we could continue the Northwest Coast Housing Project in the Shishal territory. And frankly, I have to say, I have to admit that one of the main reasons for the switch from Prince Rupert after 15 years to 10 or 12 years of research in the Shishal territory is that the Shishal territory is referred by most people in British Columbia as the Sunshine Coast.
The listener can't see Gary's shirt right now, but you can tell he's a man who likes sunshine.
Well, yeah, you get, and Prince Rupert is famous for its level of precipitation, staggering amount of rain. So I was ready to move to a drier location, but I wanted to continue doing household archaeology, and I thought we had a good opportunity for that in the Shishal region. Spoke with representatives of the Shishal Nation. They seemed to be enthusiastic and receptive to the idea, and we thought we had a really good site with a deep midden. It was somewhat disturbed in the last 50 years or so, but not terribly. We thought there were areas that were undisturbed where we might find house features. And one summer before I got to the field, I had a couple of graduate students who were out looking at the site and doing some preliminary testing to see where might we find house features and house floors and do household archaeology. And I got a call from one of my students who said, you know what, we've got an eroding cut bank here, and there are beads, lots and lots of stone beads that just seem to be falling out of this cut bank. So this eroding cut bank is some recent disturbance. It's obviously cut into an older feature, archaeological feature, cultural feature. And the feature contains a lot of stone beads, which are now falling out of this cut bank slope. And my first thought was, oh no, you guys have found probably the remains of a burial. So I said, first of all, stop working on it. Let's report this to the Shishal Nation and see where we go from there. And so we did. And the long story short, the Shishal Nation and the province of British Columbia were sort of in competition for this particular site location, which the Shishal Nation wanted control of, but province of British Columbia for various reasons, but the province of British Columbia was saying, no, this is crown land. This is not on any of your designated reserves. Shishal people were saying, well, it should be a reserve. They were at a bit of an impasse. And the elected chief of the nation said to me, I said, I think these are burials that we found. I think we found maybe two different burials that have been cut through by previous non-archaeological work at the site. What do you want us to do? And if they are burials, can you prove that? Well, we can investigate. We might find human remains. That would pretty much prove it, but these would be ancestors, the remains of ancestors. He said, let me talk to elders and so on. There was a long discussion. We hadn't started field work. I was wondering, are we going to have any field work? He got back to me and said, we would like you to proceed with the excavation of these burials. Because we think this will provide powerful evidence that this is an important, very important traditional site to our people, and we can, show this evidence to the province. And so on that basis, we did. And I think it ended up being an example of collaborative archaeology with a BC First Nation group, an example of collaborative archaeology, mortuary archaeology that I think ended up, I ended up feeling good about doing this excavation when, you know, for years before that, I just, I don't want to excavate burials. I don't want to touch burials. But under these circumstances, under these conditions, I think, yeah, this is something I, if I would feel good about going ahead and doing this, if this is what you want me to do. And so we did. We found hundreds of thousands of beads, clearly in burial context with human remains, other evidence of wealth. And what was very interesting was that when we dated, radiocarbon dated these burial features, the dates came back at about 4,000 years old. Up to that point, the theory, the model that I had been working on, and I think many other, but not all, Northwest Coast archaeologists, was that inequality, complexity, if you want, was much more recent than that, by at least a couple of thousand years even. So here we had evidence of incredibly wealthy burials, huge amount of material wealth in the form of these beads, about at least 1,500 years older than what we thought would have been the beginnings of that kind of complexity. So that really, that made me, Ken made reference to the book that R.G. Matson and I had written 30 years ago, and we pushed the idea that complexity came about 2,500 years ago to the Northwest Coast, not 4,000 years. That's way too early. Now here was evidence that I think we were wrong. And not only were we wrong about the origins of complexity, it made me begin to think, are we thinking the right way about complexity and inequality? Is it something that finally comes along, and then once it's there, there's no going back? Is it a progressive evolutionary development, kind of old 19th century thinking, but hard to escape sometimes? Or should we be thinking about this inequality as something that emerges at certain times and in certain places on the Northwest Coast, as well as in other regions, and maybe lasts for a number of generations, maybe a few centuries or even more, enough to leave an archaeological record? But then for some reason, whatever the conditions change, and that inequality is a little bit later on is not emphasized so much. And it rises and falls rather than this progressive march ever onward, ever upward towards, you know, civilization.
It's not just complex, it's complicated.
Complex, it's complicated. Yeah. So I think that was a rambling answer to about three or four.
No, that's perfect. And for the listener too, if you've been to the Canadian Museum of History, I believe that if it's still there, maybe Gabe, you've been there more recently than I have. But one time there was an exhibit that those ancestors from Shishelt are part of an exhibit that did some digital reconstruction of the family or the individuals that were found at those burials. So
they were able to use the human remains, do facial reconstruction, and if those burial remains do represent a single family, what exactly do we mean by family? But certainly represented the remains of a group of people who lived together and who lived at this particular site, this particular location, 3,800, 4,000 years ago. That was a pretty interesting development that came out of it too. So I think some very good archaeological work was done there, and in collaboration with and in the service of First Nations groups whose these were their ancestors. This is their territory, and these were their ancestors. So it was a unique, I don't know, very rare and unusual opportunity.
Well, Gary, thanks for joining us to talk about these topics. We appreciate you coming on and sharing some of the information from the other coast.
Yeah, my pleasure. I never did talk about the cultivation.
Natasha
Lyons is never going to forgive me if I didn't mention them. but were they just hunter gatherers? There is evidence now from the coast on the lower Fraser River of camas bulbs, which are an edible tuber. Certainly an important plant food resource. We never thought that they were cultivated, that they were just gathered wild. But there's evidence now from the lower Fraser River that maybe they were gardened to increase production of camas bulbs. There are evidence of reconstructed shorelines and rebuilt shorelines. Clam gardens, I think, is the term that's used for them. Dana Lepofsky and others have been working on these sites where groups were clearly reworking the intertidal zone to extend the shoreline to increase and improve shellfish productivity. No question about that. And they're, the term that is being thrown around now is clam gardens. So were they entirely hunter-gatherers, non-agricultural? That's debatable. I don't think there are many examples of that on the West Coast, but there are a few. So
Richard Lee was right, is what you're telling us.
No, I don't think so. But he does have some ammunition there. He does have some...
This wasn't on the question list, but one of the things I was thinking about as I was reading about the size of the shell midden at the site in Prince Rupert, the name is eluding me right now, at the mouth of McNichol Creek.
Well, yeah, the site in McNichol, yeah.
Is there the same kind of evidence there that these shell deposits were just middens, or were they like a kind of like terraforming, like what you see, for example, in the southeast? Like, is there sort of intentionality around the shaping and the size and the location of the shell deposits?
Right. I mean, at that particular site that you mentioned, I didn't see evidence necessarily of terraforming, but a big deep shell midden that formed the kind of back boundary of a small village site at the mouth of McNichol Creek. But farther south, I think Colin Greer and Andrew Martindale have some evidence, and Andrew Martindale may have evidence from the Prince Rupert area, but not the site, from the site that you mentioned, of shell midden terraforming, which, as I see it, as I understand it, was largely a process of the shell being dumped in big mounds, and then at some later point, the surface of those mounds was leveled off, maybe to create level living surfaces to build on, or to conduct other activities. I'm not sure what, but it does seem that in some cases, terraforming of these shell midden deposits was done to create surfaces that I'm not sure what their function was.
Yeah, we'll leave the last question here about people who lived in big houses, maybe for another discussion. We'll get you and Ted on here to talk about big houses sometime. Maybe
Ted Banning. Yeah,
yeah.
We should do it in a. I think there's an exhibit at CMH, isn't there, still, of a big house? We could all sit in it.
There was a Salish house on the lower Fraser River near where these camas gardens have been discovered. A Salish house that Simon Fraser, recorded on his descent of the river that now bears his name in 1808. A single house. Oh, a cat has joined us.
Yeah, Elwood is stopping by here.
What's the movie with Steve Martin? Somebody get that cat. A single house under a single continuous roof that measured 200 meters in length.
Oh, wow.
Along the river shoreline, 200 meter long house by about 10 meters wide. So if you want to talk about long houses, this was a long house. Probably with a household of maybe several hundred people, you know. How do you figure that out? But the number of hearths in the house, just the size of it, a lot of people could have lived in that house at any given time. So there's an example of people who lived in big houses.
Well, thanks again, Gary, for coming
thanks
on.
Thanks so
today.
Much,
this
Gary.
This has been awesome.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for joining
us. Talk soon.
Well, Ken, and now it's time for Hit Pieces.
This is going to be our first live Hit Pieces segment, I think.
I think it is.
Maybe.
Yes.
It might be. Although, I think we recorded something with Sarah Beanlands one time that was
emotional
in nature.
We may have.
Yeah. So we're going to go backwards.
Oh, no, Ken, we recorded this before the one with Sarah Beanlands. This was years ago that we did this. We knew Vermont Archaeology Week would be coming.
Exactly.
In fact, 30 years ago, when Ken and I were at the inaugural Vermont Archaeology Week, we thought to ourselves, we should probably sit down in the offices of Vermont Public Radio and record very thing with Jess Robinson.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And so we're going to turn it over to ourselves and to Jess Robinson here. And listener, one of the things that we want you to stay tuned for is that we just got a new drop of swag, including some Season 4 stickers and some die-cut New Brunswick NB Arc Pod stickers. And so if you're going to write in, we will actually get some mail out and get you some of these hot new stickers.
Yes, and listener, if you run a small lapel pin company somewhere in North America, please let us know, because one of these stickers really looks a lot like a lapel pin.
It does, and stay tuned for your next conference. Maybe we'll see one there.
All right. Ken, I'll talk to you 30 years ago.
Yeah. Talk to you soon, listener, and Gabe, we'll see you on the space-time continuum.
See you there. So, Ken, we've got a very special hit piece today. We are actually joined by Dr. Jess Robinson, who is the state Vermont state archaeologist, and he's here to tell us about Vermont Archaeology Month, which some of our listeners may be interested in.
Yeah, just wanted to let folks know that it's Vermont Archaeology Month this year, and it's actually our 30th anniversary. Started in 1995 by the Vermont Archaeological Society, and they're still a collaborator with the Division for Historic Preservation, which now heads up the month. There's various activities all over the state. There's a society meeting up near Lake Willoughby in Brownington at the end of the month. There's the Atlatl competition, which has been going on for 30 years, down at Chimney Point State Historic Site on Lake Champlain, which is fantastic, and a number of other events. So I think the best way to learn about the events going on is to look at the Vermont Archaeology Month Facebook page. We'd hope to see you all come out. And there's a few virtual things, I believe, too, in case you want to tune in from home.
And for the listener, that is facebook.com/Vermont Archaeology Month. Vermont Archaeology Month, all one word, archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY. And you can also find them on Twitter, twitter.com/VTArchaeology, archaeology spelled the same way. And on Instagram, instagram.com/Vermont Archaeology, archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY.
That's right. And through the miracle of Zoom, the listener is going to hear from Jess again in about 14 days.
Thanks, Jess.
Thanks.
The New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast.